Next on Fronteras, for immigrant families with mixed status, life can seem unfair at times.
I get to fight for everything. Everything, you know, getting glasses, getting attention to your teeth, to everything.
We met one such family. Like millions of others, they wonder about the fate of immigration reform now that Congress is in recess. Several hundred people who call the banks of the Tijuana River Canal home were recently evicted, and some of them are responding.
We're going to stay here demanding the Tijuana government to stop the oppression and raids against the migrants that are living in El Bordo.
Coming up, we talk with some of the evicted residents of the Tijuana River Canal. But first, the news. This is Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras was created through an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among seven public radio stations. It's funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting as part of its local journalism center initiative. I'm Crystal Chavez. Excessive alcohol consumption cost U.S. taxpayers over $220 billion in 2006. That's according to a new study released by the Centers for Disease Control. And Tristan Autone reports states in the Southwest accounted for a large portion of those costs.
According to the CDC, excessive alcohol consumption, primarily binge drinking, poses a huge public health problem across the country, with major economic impacts resulting from police responses to violence to treatment of health problems related to alcohol. The CDC report says excessive drinkers paid less than half of the costs associated with heavy consumption. In California, the estimated cost to citizens was over $31 billion, and in Arizona, over $5 billion. The CDC's Robert Brewer says in New Mexico, excessive drinking in 2006 brought a price tag of nearly $2 billion, which breaks down to about $960 per person.
This is a very expensive problem in New Mexico, and about 42% of those costs are paid for by government. There's a large cost to taxpayers in covering expenses like health care, criminal justice, and lost productivity as well.
Brewer hopes the report will help policymakers understand the public health risks of heavy drinking through an economic lens. In Albuquerque, I'm Tristan Autone.
Among the millions of immigrant families living in the United States, many have mixed legal status. One member may be here illegally, another might have a temporary permit, and yet another may be a U.S. citizen. This creates uncomfortable disparities within families. With Congress out on recess and the future of immigration reform uncertain, it leaves their lives in limbo. Monica Ortiz Uribe reports.
At a pizza joint in Las Cruces, New Mexico, a father and daughter fire fake plastic guns at a video game screen. A few feet away, some teenagers trade tickets for glitter bracelets. This is a favorite hangout for Cynthia Alba, a 19-year-old Mexican immigrant who entered the United States illegally when she was just a toddler.
So I remember playing in my grandmother's garden with some little plastic toys.
That was Alba's last memory of her birth country. She left with her mother, who was escaping an abusive relationship. They moved in with a relative in New Mexico, and Alba's mother worked cleaning houses. Last year, Alba qualified for President Obama's Deferred Action Program, which puts off deportation proceedings for immigrants brought to the U.S. illegally as children. Up until now, she couldn't get a job, pay for college, or afford medical care.
I get to fight for everything. Everything, you know, getting glasses, getting attention to your teeth, to everything.
An old, unattended knee injury now means Alva walks around with a limp. She hasn't gotten new glasses in more than 2 years. Meanwhile, her half-sister, Andrea Munoz, was born in this country. As a U.S. citizen, she qualifies for Medicaid and is able to get braces and see a doctor regularly. Munoz is 15 years old, shy, with pink and purple hair. She says her older sister's situation makes her feel helpless.
I get all this stuff that's like, oh yeah, we'll pay for your teeth, your braces or your glasses or your doctor's appointment. And she can barely go to the doctor because she doesn't have that. And I find it unfair because she's human and she has a right to health.
Both sisters also worry about their mother, who remains undocumented. Now that Alba has deferred action, she has a temporary work permit and recently got a job as a Spanish interpreter. She'll soon get health care benefits from her employer, but her long-term future is still a big question mark.
I don't know what I'll be doing in 10 years. I'm just scared of next year in December because that's when my deferred action runs out.
The Pew Hispanic Center estimates there are some 9 million people in a mixed status family, which includes members without legal documentation as well as U.S. citizens. In the Southern District of New Mexico, represented by Republican Congressman Steve Pierce, the Pew Center estimates there are 19,000 young immigrants that qualify for deferred action. Sarah Nolan leads a faith-based organization in Las Cruces that works with immigrant families.
And a few months ago, Representative Pierce voted to defund deferred action and expedite their removal. And these are students and young adults that are really contributing and wanting to be and be professionals in our country and stay in New Mexico.
In a letter to Nolan's organization, Representative Pierce said it's unfair to reward those who broke the law by allowing them to remain in the United States. He opposes a path to citizenship for more than 11 million immigrants here illegally. Pierce is among the majority in the U.S. House of Representatives who hold this position. He supports tackling immigration in numerous separate bills as opposed to one single comprehensive bill. Reporting from Las Cruces, New Mexico, I'm Monica Ortiz Uribe.
Law enforcement in Tijuana this month evicted hundreds of people who live in makeshift homes on the banks of the concrete-lined Tijuana River. Frontera's reporter Adrian Florido visited to see how these people, among Tijuana's most destitute, are faring.
The concrete channel that carries the slow trickle of the Tijuana River along the U.S.-Mexico border fence is known as El Bordo. Hundreds, possibly thousands of people, mostly migrants deported from the U.S., live on the edge of the canal in little lean-tos or in holes dug into piles of sand. On Monday morning, about 8:15, a team of federal and municipal officers swarmed the canal, arrested 90 people, evicted hundreds more, and destroyed their lean-tos and filled in the dugout holes.
De repente llegaron nada más muchas patrullas y...
Juan Carlos García Pérez says the officers arrived suddenly. Some people ran away, but others were roused from their holes and taken into custody. They started destroying everything, he says, knocking homes down. After the raid, a nonprofit called Angels Without Borders showed up with tents. It helped some of the migrants set up a camp in a barren little plaza separated from the canal by a four-lane highway. Hugo Castro is coordinating the effort.
We're going to stay here demanding the Tijuana government to stop the oppression and raids against the migrants that are living in El Bordo.
City officials have struggled with how to handle the population that lives in the Tijuana River Canal. Many have drug habits. Most were deported from the U.S. and therefore have no family ties in Tijuana. The police chief and other city officials blame the migrants for much of the city's crime and also for a public health threat posed by sharing of needles in the canal. Victor Clark Alfaro is a lecturer at San Diego State University who's observed the canal for many years. He says police have frequently raided it, but this time was different.
Fue con el propósito de finalmente limpiar todo el canal.
Their goal was to clear the canal out once and for all, to put an end to what has become a major social problem, he says. Tijuana officials were not immediately available for interviews, but after Monday's raid, the police department issued a statement saying the raid was meant to protect the migrants living in the canal and to prevent crime. It also said the federal government will invest more than $3 million for social programs to solve the problem of deported migrants in the canal and in nearby zones, though details remain scarce. Some projects are already underway to keep people away from the canal. In the last month, the government erected a steel fence down the center of the four-lane highway that separates the canal from downtown Tijuana. It makes it harder to get into the canal, and it looks like a smaller version of the U.S. government's border fence that towers on the other side of the canal. The irony isn't lost on Pedro Castillo, who was kicked out of the canal on Monday.
Fíjate, nos pusieron otra pinche barda, estos vatos. Somos deportados otra vez.
They built another fence, he says. It's like they've deported us again. What are we supposed to do, he asks. Most of the migrants say they have no choice but to try to return to the canal. It was the first thing Hermes Ramirez Camacho did when he was released from jail Tuesday afternoon after 36 hours. His little shack had been destroyed, but what he really cared about was his guitar. He'd left it behind in the haste of his arrest. Ramirez is 51, tall, skinny, and with a wrinkled face. He's known as the canal's unofficial musician. He earns money going from bar to bar playing tunes. My guitar's my paycheck. It's what feeds me, he says. And when he got back to the canal, it was gone. He asked around desperately, with no luck, until finally he found a man who said he'd saved it. He charged Ramirez 40 pesos, about $3, to get it back. It had a big crack in it, but it still sounded. Ramirez already rebuilt his little shack in the canal. Indeed, within a day of the police raid, many people were already back, erecting posts and hanging up tarps and digging new holes into the sand. Reporting from Tijuana, I'm Adrian Florido.
There's still more Fronteras coming up here about a civil rights giant who's become a comic book hero. Stay tuned. This is Fronteras. Welcome back. I'm Crystal Chavez. One of Mexico's most isolated indigenous groups has won a significant legal victory. Mexican courts have suspended logging permits affecting old-growth forests in the group's ancestral territory in the Sierra Madre of northern Mexico. At the same time, export demand for the lumber is growing, and there's pressure to open up logging on other parts of indigenous land. For the Fronteras desk, Lorne Madelon reports from the Mexican state of Chihuahua.
Flying above the Sierra Madre, you see an emerald carpet of pine forests, steep canyons, and soaring mountains framed by an indigo sky. It's home to the Tarahumara, an indigenous Indian group whose rugged terrain has allowed them to resist occupation since the Spanish conquest. They're fighting still, this time against loggers and the Mexican government. The demand for quality hardwoods abroad is running roughshod over the Tarahumara. They sell some of their forests to legally registered buyers. Last fall, a Mexican court banned logging on a vast tract of Tarahumara territory. But that was only after outsiders had illegally cut millions of dollars worth of trees on indigenous land. Tarahumara elders thought the ruling would set a precedent. It didn't. Illegal logging continues. And now, Mexico's equivalent of the EPA has ruled that loggers can harvest on another large tract of what the Tarahumara say is theirs.
When there is a claim in court discussing property or possession, the environmental agency cannot issue logging permits.
Lawyer Fernanda Venzon disputes the Mexican EPA's permits. She worked on the earlier case that the Tarahumara won. She claims that in this current conflict, more than just a land title is needed before any logging permit should be granted.
This is an indigenous community, and in such cases, the communities have to be consulted before such a logging permit can be issued, and they were not consulted.
Pero es una demanda colectiva para...
That's Ernesto Palencia, the Tarahumara's lawyer. He's in a damp, roofless wood hut in the Sierra, telling people that another court battle looms. Sunbeams dance on pillars of smoke drifting up from a wood fire. He says he thought the initial victory, funded in part by private citizens in the U.S., would mean that all indigenous land would be protected. Now he's appealing against logging in this second disputed area.
Bueno, ha sido difícil intentar...
It's been difficult to defend land claims for indigenous people, he says. There are legal protections, but they aren't applied. Pro-business factions, and that includes some Tarahumara, defend the project, saying the cash infused into the Sierra raises the standard of living of everyone. The Mexican EPA chief, who gave loggers permission to harvest on what the Tarahumara claim is their land, is Ignacio Castillo.
Estos papeles dicen que es su territorio.
He says documents prove logging interests own the land. But the Tarahumara claim those papers are fraudulent.
Mucha gente la de fuera ve que hay muchos árboles.
Marcelina Bustillos is a defiant and very popular indigenous governor here. She claims outsiders are stealing trees, a resource that protects the land's ability to retain water and a cultural icon that links the temporal Tarahumara world to the heavens.
Yo digo que primeramente...
In July, Bustillos made a forceful case for the Tarahumara during a race for a seat for the Chihuahua State Legislature. She lost, but not before injecting a conversation about disputed land claims into the campaign. The governor says loggers want us to leave, and the government effectively tells them to ignore the court. This land belongs to us, she says.
El territorio de aquí de la sierra es nuestro.
Every day, trucks laden with huge old-growth trees navigate the copper-colored mud tracks that have been gouged through the forest. One truck driver says he's conflicted. He needs the work. But he also has no love lost for his bosses.
Se maltratan nomás los pinillos donde tumban material grueso.
He says they're not treating the forest well. They're just clear-cutting. The appeal against logging in the second area is underway. But the Tarahumara aren't optimistic. The bureaucrat, who in the earlier case ruled in favor of the loggers, has quit his job to become an advisor to the staunchly pro-business mayor of the Chihuahua State Capitol. For Fronteras, I'm Lorne Madelon.
John Lewis began life as the son of sharecroppers on a farm in rural Alabama. He went on to speak alongside Martin Luther King Jr. at the March on Washington and to become a U.S. congressman. Now his incredible life story is the subject of a graphic autobiography. KPBS reporter Sandhya Dirk spent time with Lewis when he was in San Diego recently for the annual Comic-Con convention.
Among all the superheroes wandering the floor of the convention center at this year's Comic-Con was a less conspicuous hero, civil rights champion John Lewis.
Hi. Hi, how are you? I'm
how
one
you
of
doing?
Your voters from Georgia.
Oh, good to see you.
I'm so excited.
Hundreds lined up to have him sign copies of his new autobiography, March.
Follow the line. You're not losing your spot.
So how did a congressman become a comic book author? It began with a young man who was working on the congressman's 2008 reelection campaign. That staffer's name, Andrew Aiden.
It was towards the end of the campaign. As things were winding down, folks started to talk about what they were going to do after. And unashamed, I said I would be going to a comic book convention. And there was a little teasing. But Congressman Lewis stood up for me.
And I tried to do what I could to put it down and said, you should laugh. At another time, in another period, there was a comic book called The Montgomery Story, Martin Luther King Jr. and The Montgomery Story, that inspired me.
That comic book is 15 thin pages of colored newsprint that tells the story of the Montgomery protest sparked by Rosa Parks' 1955 refusal to give up her seat on a public bus. But it also serves as something else, a primer on the nonviolent method. It was a lesson that John Lewis put to use as he and fellow students planned sit-ins at segregated lunch counters in the early 1960s. His staffer, self-professed fanboy Andrew Aiden, quickly became convinced Lewis should tell his own story as a comic.
I thought he was somewhat out of his mind. Why would I be writing a comic book? He didn't give up. He didn't give in. He was persistent. And he came back and said, Congressman, let's write a comic book. And I do remember reading the Montgomery Story comic book. And I said, yes, if you would do it with me.
This is the first of three books that will span the congressman's 70 decades. And it begins with stories of a young John Lewis tending chickens on his family farm, trying out sermons on the birds. Graphic artist Nate Powell says it is these very human beginnings that give him and the reader the audacity to see from Lewis's perspective.
There were certain moments, free of context, where I felt like I could simply slip into his shoes for that moment, and I knew precisely what it was like to witness, you know, the baptism of these chickens, the loss of a beloved hen down a well, the hiding under the porch so that he could sneak away from his house in order to get an education each day and hop on the bus with his mom chasing after him.
That intimacy is evident in the shadowed, up-close visual perspectives that mark the early parts of the book. But Powell says there were moments where drawing the narrative gave him pause.
Trying to find the appropriate and powerful way to respectfully depict the murder of Emmett Till.
The book, its creators say, isn't just history. Like the comic book that inspired it, March is meant to be a primer for a new generation on the power of nonviolent protest. That is something co-author Andrew Aden says was never far from his mind.
This may get me in trouble, but I really believe that the generation between the congressman and Nate and I has in some sense failed us. They sold out a little bit. We, our generation, needs to pick up a torch again.
Too many people, even today, have been left out and left behind. They're black, they're white, they're Latino, they're Asian American, they're Native American. The book is trying to say that we all must continue to be restless.
Lewis says that in the age of Trayvon Martin and the recent Supreme Court decision on voting rights, young people need to find a way to connect to the greater struggle for civil rights.
I remember hearing Martin Luther King Jr. preached from time to time, and his father would be in the pulpit, and he would say, "Son, make it plain, make it plain." So between Nate and Andrew, they made it plain.
As plain as a picture. For Fronteras, I'm Sandhya Dirks.
You've been listening to Fronteras, a Corporation for Public Broadcasting-funded journalism project covering the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations KJZZ Phoenix, KPBS San Diego, KNAU Flagstaff, KNPR Las Vegas, KRWG Las Cruces, KUAZ Tucson, and KSTX San Antonio. We're online at fronterasdesk.org. We're also on Facebook, and we invite you to join the conversations there and post your thoughts about our stories. For headlines and updates, you can follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @fronterasdesk. You may subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. This theme music was composed by Charanga Cakewalk. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez. Thanks for listening.